So it doesn't have to start from the beginning, but just yell out anything you can think of, and I'll try to put them on the board in some sort of order so that we can maybe picture a little bit our history. So just...
Jamestown.
Jamestown, okay. What's up near the top?
Tea party.
War against Canada, 1812.
Facts about representation.
Okay, I'll just... Anytime during American
Scopes
history.
Trial.
Scopes trial.
1930 something.
1934. Spanish American
War.
Civil War.
Progressive movement or progressive era?
Progressive movement.
McCarthyism.
First and Second World Wars.
First World War.
And all the others. Korea, Vietnam.
Second.
Suffrage. 1919, is that right? Civil rights legislation, 54.
Is it coming back at all? What did someone else yell out to him? Prohibition.
You want recent history?
Prohibition was just before the women's suffrage, right? Because that was the 18th Amendment, 1918.
What about the environmental movement?
Assassination of?
Kennedy. Who was assassinated? Lincoln.
Oops.
Yeah, oh.
1960. Lincoln. April 4th, 1865.
When was Kennedy? 68. Who, Kennedy? Which one?
Anything else?
Nixon's impeachment.
Resignation.
Resignation.
The only one impeached was Johnson.
Yeah. No, he wasn't impeached either.
Mayflower contact.
Mayflower contact.
What year? Must have been 1620. Not sure where on the ocean they were.
Kind of reaching here.
1800.
The landing on the moon.
Landing on the moon. 68 again, right?
Articles of Confederation.
Articles of Confederation. 18.
No, they were before the current Constitution.
Oh, the Articles. I thought you meant the Civil War Declaration. That would be 1770 something.
1780.
Okay. And Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
What year?
1776.
I like the way you say it.
What is that?
Gold Rush?
Gold Rush.
Oh,
San Francisco 49ers.
Oh.
Wilson Clark.
Who was it, Clark?
1803, I think.
1803?
Eight or something like that.
Okay, that's good enough, just to get us started.
Did New Mexico ever come into the state?
I don't know. Does anyone know if New Mexico is a state? I'm going to start back at the beginning. Bill talked about the Mayflower, so I'm going to start with the Pilgrims. Because the Pilgrims occupy an important part of our national history, not only for what they accomplished, not only because they were strong people, but because they supply us with another one of our national symbols, which is the symbol of the pilgrimage. And I looked up pilgrim, and a pilgrim is not only a traveler, a sojourner, or a wanderer, but a pilgrim is also defined by his or her destination. A pilgrim is someone en route to a holy place. So pilgrimage is or the journey. I think is one of our national symbols. First point I want to make is that many of the early settlers that came to America, especially the New England Puritans, saw themselves on a pilgrimage. And first of all, I don't want to destroy any of your impressions of the Puritans, but the Puritans did not wear black and white and have the pointy hats. Pilgrims were not, or Puritans were not killjoys. They had a lot of fun. They drank a lot of beer. They wore colorful clothes. They were not starved of beauty. Their architecture is very beautiful. So I like Puritans. So I want to straighten that out. But they were very pious religious people. And that's a correct impression that we have, that many of the Puritans came over for religious freedom. And there's a big argument among historians on whether or not the Puritans came over mainly for religious freedom or mainly for economic motivations. And some economic interpretations of American history now have tended to throw out the religious interpretation, but I'd like to throw it back in because I think it's very important.
Well, Bill. The freedom to practice religion exactly the way they practiced it, not for anyone else.
Right, right. I'll get to that in a second. It's not, their coming over to America wasn't just running away from the past. It wasn't just escaping religious oppression in England. But the Puritans had a sense of real newness of the New World. There was something unique about America, something innocent about it. It was sort of like the Garden of Eden or Adam before the fall. It was a fresh start, a place where they could begin anew, and there were lots of reasons for that. One was just there was no aristocracy already set up. People could start out on the same foot, and no one had a head start. It was undisturbed except for some Indians, which they tried to ignore. And it wasn't all great. It was really a mixture between paradise and barren wilderness. It was a place of danger and temptation. But it was precisely right here in the wilderness that God had led them to a holy place where something new and different was going to happen. So many people saw themselves on a pilgrimage. Second point I want to make is what Bill started to say. It's not fair to say that the Puritans came just for religious freedom in terms of wanting to come to a place where everyone could do their own thing. These people had a very clear idea about what they wanted their new society to be and very determined to bring that about. So it wasn't just a pilgrimage only, but it was also a religious mission. That's the second point I want to make, that people came over here on a mission. And that was part of the uniqueness of the New World, that because it was so new, because there were so many possibilities, that it demanded of the people who came over a special task. So more than a pilgrimage into a new future, it was a missionary attempt to shape that new world. And the Puritan mission, of course, was shaped by what the people thought God's will for their lives was. They didn't just come over and start something or think of something on the boat that they could do, but they came over with a sense of divine calling. that God's rule now could begin on earth. And that was their vision, that God had selected them to create a brand new society that was modeled after the Bible. And we're going to read one of the clearest documents, and certainly one of the earliest, that I think expresses that sense of mission very clearly. It's on this side of your sheet. And it's a sermon / lecture by John Winthrop, who was the head of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. They came over to America in 1630. Dan needs one. It came over in 1630. This lecture or sermon was given on the boat. They hadn't even arrived yet. And I think it very clearly describes what sort of mission these people are on and what kind of responsibilities they now have as they enter the new country. It's called A Model for Christian Charity. And I've got the places marked where I'll read from. Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into covenant with him for this work. We have taken out a commission. The Lord hath given us leave to draw our own articles. We have professed to enterprise these actions upon these and these ends. We have hereupon besought him of favor and blessing. Now if the Lord shall please to hear us and bring us in peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant and sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. But if we shall neglect the observation of these articles, which are the ends we have propounded, and dissembling with our God, shall fall to embrace the present world and prosecute our carnal intentions, seeking great things for ourselves and our posterity, the Lord will surely break out in wrath against us, be revenged of such a perjured people, and make us know the price of the breach of such a covenant. We shall find that the God of Israel is among us when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, when he shall make us a praise and glory that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall shame the faces of the many gods worthy of God's many of God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us, till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are going. Anything strike you about that? What kind of images are there for these new people coming over?
Old Testament.
Jesus. Old Testament. How do you know it's Old Testament?
I've read Exodus.
Okay. I was struck by how many times covenant was used. The word covenant used 4 or 5 times in there. I think what Winthrop, and if you look at other people that are speaking around this time, what they're doing is they're reminding the audiences that the American people have struck a covenant with God, just as the people of Abraham and Isaac had a covenant with specific laid out responsibilities for the people. And if the American people should abide by the covenant, God's blessings would shine upon the people, and he would richly reward them. He would call them his people and lead them into the promised land. But if they did not fulfill God's laws, he would cause their prayers to turn into curses. I think this helps us understand how the Puritans who came understood themselves to be part of something much larger than themselves. And we have to understand the seriousness with which they came over. They simply could not fail. And this is really where we have the beginning of the American success ethic. Because they had to succeed, because any misfortune or any improvement that happened to the community was seen as a signal of whether or not they were abiding by the covenant or not. So to fail was not only a human failure, but to fail would have meant that somehow you had broken the covenant, or that God was not with you. So these people just had to succeed. And that mindset led to enormous dedication, hard work, discipline, a suspicion of idleness. Idleness is the devil's workshop, and that's where we get all that stuff, because these people were so serious about what they were doing, because to fail meant that somehow you had broken the covenant or not lived up to your responsibilities. And that's what Winthrop was trying to say to the people, that they had a special obligation, and not only to each other, but to God and to the rest of the world. He says, For we must consider that we shall be a city upon a hill, the eyes of all people are upon us. Instantly, where does that come from? Do you remember reading that somewhere last week? Sermon on the Mount. It's a sense that this was not only important for them, but the rest of the world, meaning mainly Europe, was watching this great experiment to see what would happen. And in the Puritans' minds, if they succeeded, that would certainly lead to the spiritual reform of all of Europe, and eventually would end the Reformation and complete it. It's important to know, too, that this was not just rhetoric that the people just sort of brushed aside and said, yeah, yeah, but it was part of their consciousness. The Bible was the one book that Americans in the 17th and 18th century were expected to know. They probably knew it very well. Many of the people who came over were very pious. They were probably screened before they were allowed to come for their commitment. So they would have taken this biblical imagery very seriously. And it became clear to them in searching scripture for texts that supported their needs and their views that the Puritans discovered many similarities between themselves and the Israelites of the Old Testament. That became immediate right away. And it soon became obvious to them that they were indeed the modern day equivalent of the people of Israel entering the Promised Land. And what Winthrop and other speakers were saying was, what they were trying to do is translating that journey into an exodus and labeling themselves the chosen people of God. Some of the similarities between them and the Israelites, first of all, they already thought of themselves as oppressed people because they had to leave England to come over and practice their religion. So it goes back to the Egyptian captivity. Egypt now equals Europe. Pharaoh is James the First, he's the king. The immigrants cross the Red Sea, which is the Atlantic, and come to America, which is New Canaan. They saw all of this as part of their experience, and this is how they interpreted it. Now that they were in New Canaan, they could come and begin their holy task to bring about God's kingdom on earth. They would be a light to a nation, a city upon a hill, a persecuted people, yet chosen by God. And that was, the imagery was also reflected in the kinds of names they chose for the towns in the early settlers chose, like Salem, Bethel, Nazareth, Bethlehem. Children's names that were popular at that time were Samuel, Benjamin, Eli, Judith, Abraham, David, Esther, Rachel. They also felt that they had leaders comparable to that of Moses and Joshua. And Moses was either John Winthrop or especially John Cotton. Was one of the great leaders of Massachusetts Bay Colony, was seen as the Moses figure that led the people to the Promised Land. On John Cotton's tomb, his inscription read, "But let this mourning flock be comforted, though Moses be, yet Joshua is not dead. I mean renowned Norton. John Norton was his successor. Worthy he successor to our Moses is to be, O happy Israel in America, in such a Moses, such a Joshua." Mm-hmm. I'm going to skip a little bit now, even though I like this stuff, but I want to show you how the same biblical imagery was kept in the 18th century as the colonies moved toward nationhood. And lots of things are different now in the mid-1700s. First of all, you have many different people coming over to America, lots of different religious groups. There's religious diversities. 13 colonies and 9 of them had established religions, but not one of those was strong enough to dominate the whole country. But most importantly, the issues of the day had changed. Political and economic issues now were the most controversial instead of religious issues. But even amidst the diversity of of the groups in the counties, there's lots of communication now between the 13 counties, and what they discovered that they had in common was the challenge of the new country, the political issues, the economic issues, the oppression of Britain, the heavy taxes, and they all had the opportunity to be freed from the arms of Britain. So those are the things that they had in common. What I want to point out is that although the issues changed in the 1700s, the biblical imagery did not. The Bible was still very important in people's minds, even though the church may have declined a little bit in their power. But by the time of the Revolution, that mentality of chosen people had been implanted, and it made for a very easy identification between the new nation and the children of Israel. And the increasing political differences between the colonies and Britain was just seen as a continuation of ancient Israel's struggle against their ungodly neighbors. So there was still a sense of chosenness, a special calling, but now Egypt is still Europe, but specifically England. Pharaoh now is George III. And Moses now is George Washington. Who leads the people out of the hands of tyranny on this land and sets up a new covenant. In order to provide biblical support now for the revolution, American leaders continue to draw on their past for meeting. And they did what other people have done in history. They made liturgy out of their history. And you can see this in the Bible. It's very evident in the Old Testament. The Israelites had their primal story. That was explained in Deuteronomy, and then all throughout the Old Testament, they based their whole life on that primal story. That's how they lived out their life, just repeating this over and over. And I'll read the primal story in the Old Testament from Deuteronomy. Moses is talking to the people. And you shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, an outstretched arm, with great terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Okay, switch yourself now to 18th century America, a New England governor, around the time of the Revolution. This is someone who drew upon what he thought was a very similar history. May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, our fathers were Englishmen, which came over this great ocean, and were ready to perish in this wilderness, but they cried unto the Lord, and he heard their voice and delivered them to the promised land. Very, very similar kinds of history in their minds. A typical first sentence in the Boston Gazette around the Revolution. My dear countrymen, my sincere wish and prayer to God is that our Israel may be saved from the rapacious jaws of a tyrant. This is very much in the minds of the people that they were Israel and Britain was Egypt and the Egyptians. The Revolution for Independence then becomes the focus now for America's mission, because the only way America could fulfill God's will or God's purposes is to be politically and economically free. There's no other way they can do it now, so the Revolution takes on a special significance. So we have to look at the Revolution as more than just 13 colonies breaking away from England, more than just a new nation setting up a new type of government. But the Revolution, in many people's eyes, was the next step that God had in mind for them. To be a laboratory of democracy. Thomas Jefferson called it the world's best hope, that a demonstration of a free society approved by God. Does anyone know what it says, the inscription on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, or where it's from? Leviticus 25:10, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And this is what people really thought of the Revolution, much bigger than just a new form of government. But by setting up this government, America would set off the beginning of a movement, or the conversion of the world, so to speak. Because if America succeeded, then their independence would probably touch off waves of revolution all over Europe. And a whole new era would begin in which all men would be free. And I say men, not because I'm trying to be exclusive, because that's what it was back then, is that men were free. Again, do you feel the sense that we dare not fail just because this is so important? There's too much at stake, namely the redemption of the whole world. And that explains why so many people were willing to take so much risk. George Washington didn't have to be involved in the revolution. He was doing very well. He had this big plantation in Virginia, but he gave it up or was willing to risk it for the revolution. He could have lost everything. Washington alluded to the fact that freedom, democracy, and the destiny of the republican model of government are justly considered, perhaps as deeply as finally, staked on the experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. So now the whole burden of proof of what America should be to the world as an expression of God's will was staked, rest with the success of the American Revolution and the success of this new government. Incidentally, what's the covenant now that the people have to abide by? It's not the Bible anymore. You know what the covenant would be during the revolution?
Articles of Confederation.
Articles of Confederation, especially the Declaration of Independence now. But why would the Declaration of Independence be the covenant? Declaration of Independence say anything about God? I don't have any copies with me, and I should have maybe reprinted, but God language is used 4 different times in the Declaration of Independence. Is it, can everyone remember the most famous? No, that's in the...
Endowed by their creator.
All men are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. So human rights are not given by the government. Human rights actually come from God. They're intended by God as a political means to bring about God's will on earth. So the ideas expressed in the Declaration of Independence now are the covenant to be obeyed in order for America to faithfully do God's will. It's interesting, on the day that the Declaration of Independence was adopted, which was?
July 2nd.
Sure, I knew. On that day, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson were appointed to be a committee for preparing a design for the Great Seal of the United States. And there were numerous suggestions, but Franklin's proposal was that on one side of the Great Seal, there would be a crowned pharaoh, sword in hand, and a speeding chariot hotly pursuing the fleeing Israelites through the Red Sea's parted waves. On the shore, an illuminated Moses with outstretched hands caused the sea to overwhelm the Egyptians, and underneath, the motto read, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." That was one of the suggestions for the Great Seal of the United States. Jefferson's suggestion also portrayed the wandering Israelites led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And it just amazes me that these men, who really weren't devoutly religious men, they were deists, they probably thought that religion was a private matter and was to be kept to oneself, but that these men got together and drew on this biblical imagery for symbols that could unite and interpret their people's experience. What did they finally decide on? What is the Great Seal? Anyone bring their dollar bills? Or just get in a place where you can see them. On the front, of course, it says "In God We Trust," but on the back of the dollar bill, on one side, there's the Great Seal with a pyramid, and you can count them, with 13 layers, 13 colonies, and it's unfinished, but the top of it is the overseen by the eye of God, which indicates the Egyptian pyramid with the watchful eye of God watching the Israelites who are fleeing to the promised land. Above it in Latin it says, "God has favored our undertaking." And underneath the pyramid, it says, "Novus Ordo Seclorum," a new order of the ages. This is a declaration that the 13 colonies had established a new order. It's not just their own independence. It's not just breaking away from England, but a sense that they're starting a holy political mission and a model for the use of all people. that only begins here but is eventually for all people. This kind of imagery that we see did not just end with the revolution. It kept going. If you look at the period between the revolution and the Civil War, you'll find that there, even though there is separation of church and state, that doesn't take away the religious dimension of the political sphere. In fact, you often find that our presidents are the ones who most often appeal to spiritual powers and assume that we somehow have a special relationship with the Supreme Being. It was interesting, one of my term papers in college was on presidential inaugurations, which was really exciting. I read every presidential inauguration. And in all 36, I think there's 36, not every president gave an inauguration address because some weren't elected. But in all 36 of them, there was some sort of reference to a transcendent deity. Every one of them. And it was interesting to go through and look at the variety of images that that presidents used. God, great author, benign parent of the human race, that being, infinite power, almighty one, him, divine providence, invisible hand, it went on and on. But all of them referred to the fact that America had some sort of unique relationship with a transcendent deity. It was interesting to note, though, that none of them referred to Jesus Christ. Not one of them referred ever to Jesus Christ. I just have two of these quotes. I was talking about the new order of the ages. The first quote on the other side of your sheet is a quote from Thomas Jefferson. When I was talking about what the Declaration of Independence meant to the people, this is the best quote I could find. "May it be to the world what I believe it will be, the signal of arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind had not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. These are the grounds of hope for others." This was the sense Thomas Jefferson was writing, that America had begun a new order of the ages. I just have two presidential quotes here. The first one, I think, bears out what I was trying to say about using God in a presidential inauguration speech. This is George Washington's first inauguration speech. So this is the first time a president is ever put into office in a country that has separation of church and state. And he begins by saying, "It would be peculiarly improper to admit in this first official act my fervent supplications to that almighty being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every defect, that his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States a government instituted by themselves for these purposes, and may enable every instrument employed in its administration to execute with success the functions allotted to his charge. No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of man more than those of the United States. Every step by which we have advanced to the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency." Washington here saying that America obviously has a very special relationship with God and that God is guiding our country. Second quote, maybe a little bit less eloquent, but I think brings across the same idea. "I believe that this nation somehow is a rendezvous with destiny, that it was not by accident, but by divine plan that this continent was placed here for people from every corner of the world who had an extra love of freedom and the courage to follow through with that love to find their way to this land. And I am convinced that the American people will go on and realize our destiny." Does anyone know who said that? I should have asked about the first one. Maybe somebody would have recognized Washington's famous quote. But the second one might not be as eloquent, but it, I think, brings across the same ideas. Anyone know who said that? Which president? Any guesses?
Lincoln.
Ronald Reagan. It was before he was president, 1975. Ronald Reagan said that. What do you think about that?
What struck me is that an ancient Greek could have said the same thing. Destiny is not a Christian concept particularly, and divine, of course, could be any god or set of gods and goddesses.
Okay, so not specifically Christian. And like I said, none of them referred to Jesus Christ. Any other comments? What do you think about that quote? Rendezvous with destiny. I think that was used earlier. Rendezvous with destiny was used somewhere in our history. But Ronald Reagan drew on it.
Seems scary.
Why scary?
Because of the danger. You can justify it if you're doing just about anything.
Or it allows us to say God is on our side because we have this destiny, therefore any war we conduct or anything we do is because we're kind of God's cohort.
That sounds really arrogant, presumptuous, like we're God's gift to the world.
But why wouldn't we be? I mean, we started a free society where people could rule themselves without oppression. Why wouldn't people have that kind of impression of themselves? I mean, obviously, this was something, you have to have a sense that this was something completely new. Popular government was, and this is a big change in the way people ruled themselves. So, do you find it surprising that people used this, or do you think that it was something that just sort of slipped by and people weren't aware of it, or perhaps?
I think that they're beating our doors down literally to get in here to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think they're still doing it, and I think they're doing it for that reason. Because they think that it's a place where God has favored this country. I think other countries look at us that way, and I think a lot of us do too. I look at it
Tom, it makes me think of a conversation I had with, I don't know the exact military status, but a group of people that came from the military academy. They were at PLU campus. It's where they send top military people from different places throughout the U.S. to be trained in international affairs, and then they end up taking leadership positions in the military system, especially in connection with the State Department. And in talking to some of these people after the presentation about nuclear war and weapons and that whole issue, it was interesting to hear some of them say that most of the people in command that they had connections with really saw themselves as doing God's will, and that's why they were doing what they were doing. That's why the policies they were devising. This academy was to train people to help make U.S. policy.
Tim Wallace said that too in one of his columns in Sojourners. He had to speak to some group, I forget what it was. It was some very top people in the military, and he asked around, and I think he asked the chaplain, you know, why are these people involved in the military? And the number one reason is because they thought, for religious reasons, they thought they were doing it. So there is a sense that this kind of imagery is not dead yet. Did you feel it today, or is it only back during the revolution? I want to talk about two different ways of interpreting this American sense of destiny or mission that developed in the 17th and 18th century. Maybe two different ways to look at it. The first would be to see the American people as a model to the world, an example to the nation. A nation that had no established, no official religion, but one that was certainly under the eye of God. let me see, how to say it. America had been shown the correct formula, so to speak. God had shown them popular government, democratic rule, the principles of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So now that America had the right formula in which to live in peace and freedom, all they had to do was to live under those principles that were set up, to be faithful to that new covenant of the Declaration of Independence and then later on the Constitution. And then soon they would be emulated by all of the nations of the world. Whoever was watching, and it was the whole world, they thought, they would be a city upon the hill. And whoever was watching, upon seeing the success of this great experiment, would obviously make similar changes in their government. So, first way is to look at America as an example or as a model to the rest of the world, and others could imitate after they saw the success of America living by those principles. The first one is prevalent in colonial America and around the time of the Revolution. And it's not fair to say that there was a direct progression from the first to the second way of interpreting America's notion of destiny, but I think it's safe to say that the second interpretation is much more prevalent during the 1800s and to some extent even today. This way of interpreting America's mission, this notion puts more emphasis on the American people as a people chosen by God for a specific purpose. Emissaries, God's emissaries might be a way. Is that right? People who not only lived by example, but were obligated to actively win other people to American values. In other words, it wasn't enough just to be a city upon a hill. But American values should be propagated here and then carried or forced, if necessary, to the rest of the world. And if a few Mexicans and Indians got in the way, well, that was okay because the will of God had to march on. So the second way of seeing American mission is much more active. How else should we say it? Forced, much more expansionist.
Imperialistic.
Imperialistic. And when this change occurred is not easy to say. I mean, you can't give it a date or even a time in history. You can't say whether it was inevitable or not. People disagree on whether it was really a new sense of mission or whether it was just an extension of the old sense of mission. But there was a deterioration in our sense of mission at some point. Happened slowly, but it seemed to go hand in hand. Go ahead, Dan. It seemed to go hand in hand with territorial expansion, and as soon as we started moving west. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, did the earliest symbols connect the Indian with the Canaanite on the land that had to be?
Yeah. I don't know my Old Testament very well, but they would be seen.
When Joshua went to the promised land, he was told to get rid of the people who were there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very definitely. They were seen as people just occupying the promised land that was now going to be turned in to a land flowing with milk and honey. The only difference between the Israelites and the Americans was that now they had this barren wilderness that they had to turn into a promised land. It wasn't, a lot of people saw it right away as barren desert wilderness. Very definitely saw the Indians as in the way. By the way, Washington now is, a lot of people say that he's not really a Moses figure, but might be closer to Gideon, who with a small army defeated Britain and refused the crown after his victory. A lot of people wanted to make Washington king, and he refused. So he's closer to Gideon. But after the Revolution, Americans had lots of confidence. the victory over Britain, poor uneducated rebels defeat the Empire of England. And as a result, now America was perceived to have a further mission, not just to have political and economic freedom, not just to have freedom from Europe, but now a further mission to also conquer the wilderness, to move westward, to take the land by force if necessary, to spread this wonderful experiment of Christian democracy. And this new dimension of mission, or this extension of the old mission, became very clear as people started to move west. And that happened very quickly. In 1790, 94% of the people lived in the 13 colonies. In 1880, only 90 years later, about half of them lived in the 13 colonies. So not only people moving west, but people coming from Europe and moving west faster. I tried to pick out a quote that would express this change in destiny, and I chose one by Herman Melville, who wrote the novel. I like the way you said that. We'll read this. Escaped from the house of bondage, Israel of old did not follow after the ways of the Egyptians. To her was given an express dispensation. To her were given new things under the sun. And we Americans are the peculiar chosen people, the Israel of our time. We bear the ark of the liberties of the world. 70 years ago, we escaped from thrall, and besides our first birthright, embracing one continent of earth, God has given to us for a future inheritance the broad domains of the political pagans that shall yet come and lie down under the shade of our ark without bloody hands being lifted. God has predestined, mankind expects, great things from our race, and great things we feel in our souls. The rest of the nations must soon be in our rear. We are the pioneers of the world, the advance guard, sent on through the wilderness of untried things to break a new path in the new world that is ours. In our youth is our strength, in our inexperience our wisdom. At a period when other nations have but lisped, our deep voices heard afar. Long enough have we been skeptics with regard to ourselves and doubted whether indeed the political Messiah had come. But he has come in us, if we would but give utterance to his promptings. And let us always remember that with ourselves, almost for the first time in history of Earth, national selfishness is unbounded philanthropy. For we cannot do a good to America, but we give alms to the world. What do you think of that quote? What's he trying to say? Herman Melville wrote in first part of the 19th century, or mid-19th century. Is that right? What's Melville trying to say? Can you put it in your own words, or maybe think of a modern day expression of what Melville's trying to say?
It sounds almost like what's good for General Motors is good for America.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. What's good for General Motors is good for America, or what's good for America is good for the world. Any other reactions?
Spooky.
I just wanted, there were lots of quotes to choose from, and I'm not.
It's not pretty accurate of the entire era of Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and the whole expansionist era.
Yep.
Following the Civil War.
Just a question, like in exploring the West, was there always like a father or a priest or something, like exploring some of the, like in Minnesota and Wisconsin? I always kind of remember that, like, what is it?
Father.
Okay, and so with that, having a religious figure in these groups of people heading west, would that have been really important?
I can't say whether there would have been a preacher along with the people or not, and whether or not they were very religious, but certainly would have had this imagery in their minds that they were doing God's will. I don't know if it would have particularly had to be connected with the church, but like, you know, the Lutheran people moving to Minnesota certainly had. Dan?
Yeah.
I remember from seminary, I think it's an important statistic, that at colonial times, that 5% of the population were members of the Christian church.
From somewhere from 4 to 7% of people in America were actual members of a church body. And we have this impression that we're such a religious people around the time of the revolution. And we were religious people, we just weren't church members.
What's the percentage now?
I don't know.
67% or so, that's pretty high. But Tom, don't you think a lot of that has to do with, like, when even when Rich Kimmel was talking about Siberia, a million Lutherans in Siberia, and not until 5 years ago that they established churches. They were not a member of a church, but, you know, there were no pastors. The Lutherans came over and settled in Missouri with an organ that was put in suitcases, and I mean, I thought that doesn't really indicate maybe how Christian or how religious or how God-fearing they were. I just don't think there was the opportunity. And if you're working just to maintain yourself, you know, maybe there isn't a time to build a church or educate pastors. Or, is that?
There were two revivals in early America, one in colonial America before the Revelation, the first Great Awakening, and then the second Great Awakening in the 1800s, which caused a lot of people to join churches, but it really didn't last very long. But that's a good point. But I think this notion of destiny, the change in destiny, is an important shift, and I think it has to do with something that Dan said in the sermon last Sunday, that once you believe that God is on your side, and you begin to succeed, everything then that you acquire is seen as God's blessing. Whether or not it's right or wrong, everything that you acquire is seen as God's blessings. And as we do that individually here, we do that as a nation on a larger scale. And so when you look at speakers and writers in the 1800s, who use any religious language in connection with the nation, they talk more and more about God's manifest blessings on the country. And that's very true, because a lot of people were, and it's not true, but a lot of people were doing very well in America. But they talk less and less about a God who called the nation under judgment. In other words, the fact that America was doing so well was evidence of their being blessed by God, which caused them to believe more and more in themselves and in their ability to do God's will. So the nation no longer always acted on whether things were right or wrong, but on whether or not it was God's will. We can talk about God's will and ask whether that's really objective or subjective or not, but it was no longer on the basis of right or wrong. So instead of God's watchful eye calling people into judgment, God's, quote, blessings were used to rationalize people's behavior, including the massacre of a large part of the Native American population. Instead of having a nation under God, a people continually trying to live up to a covenant, Americans began to see themselves as inevitably blessed. Most clearly expressed, I think, in the term manifest destiny. Has anyone heard the term before, manifest destiny?
Was that Kennedy?
No, it was, I can't remember the name of the author of it, but it was written in a newspaper in 1845. It was first termed in 1845. It was used before then. I'll just read to you what was written. It's America's manifest destiny to overspread and to possess the whole of the continent, which Providence, capital P, has given us for the development of the great experiment of liberty and federated self-government entrusted to us. And that notion of manifest destiny was very prevalent in the mid-1800s. Franklin Pierce, president during the 1840s, said he asked for continued continence of the same divine care which has led us from the small beginnings to the eminence we this day occupy, with an enlarged patriotism which shall acknowledge no limits but those of our own widespread republic. So as long as God was watching, there just seemed to be no limits to where America could expand to. And it's not to say that some people didn't see limits. There were people that questioned America's need to expand farther across the country. Some people called America's mission into question, but many of them were called un-American. Just as today, if you call into question America's sphere of influence, see how quickly see how long it takes for you to be called un-American if you question our sphere of influence. But it was during this time that you had Louisiana Purchase, which expanded our boundaries considerably, the Mexican War, which was pretty unnecessary, followed by the annexation of Mexico and California, slavery expansion into other states besides those in the Deep South, and the widespread massacring of American Indians. Now, continue with this theme. When we see the movie tomorrow night, we're going to have a movie called This Bloody Blundering Business, and we showed it here last year. David Messenbring brought it up, and it's supposed to come in today. But it shows how the same sense of mission justified a foreign policy as well. In other words, as long as we were just on the American continent, there wasn't much resistance to our expansion because there weren't many people around to resist, except for some Mexicans and some Indians. But in the movie, we'll see that when we reached California, our final border, we had nowhere to go. So we moved to other parts of the world with the same concept of manifest destiny. And listen in the movie for President McKinley's quotations. I have one of them down, down here at the bottom. There was no question in McKinley's mind that we should take the Philippines in around the turn of the century because he prayed to God about it. And the problem was he always got the same answer from God. You know, sure, go ahead. The quote is, "There was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them and by God's grace do the very best we could by them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died and put the Philippines on the map of the United States." Beginning of the imperialistic age where we used the same concept of destiny.
Tom, yeah. So much of what you just talked about relates to what Wallace is saying in the chapter I just read. I mean, even he says on 26, rather the American empire is based on a complex global system of economic and political domination which seeks to guarantee that we have our way in the world. And then he goes on to relate that to the evangelicals and regaining America's, quote, rightful place in the world, unquote, through a restoration of American power based on military superiority.
Yeah. With this mindset, coexistence is very hard for us to think about. And we usually think that for the Russians, coexistence is hard. But for us, if we're not number one, it's very difficult.
What does coexistence mean?
Coexistence meaning that we can live along with other nations who may be just as powerful as us or have another ideology. We have always felt that our conception of democracy, popular government, people ruling themselves would have to dominate the world. That's how the revolution was seen. I want to explain one more moment in history that reflects this religious influence on American culture. And I think it perhaps best expresses American mission, and that's the Civil War. If the first great event in our national history was the Revolution, the exodus from the old country, across the waters, and Moses or Washington leading the people out of the hands of tyranny, and then establishing the new covenant. The second great event of our history is the Civil War. And the great hero who embodies its meaning is Abraham Lincoln. And Abe Lincoln is probably our greatest national hero. He's the president who is elevated to a superhuman level more than any other president. I think it's because he has a unique history. Born in lowly surroundings, a log cabin where he studies by the flickering flame of the fireplace, but he is elected to be great and then he's faithful to that election. He leaves the past and in a struggling ascent reaches political office where he fails several times, but out of that struggle in the wilderness he achieves the presidency at a significant moment. He guides the destiny of the Union so that it is saved, but he doesn't live to see the promised land. He's assassinated and his death becomes a powerful symbol of sacrifice in behalf of the country for others to come. Some say that the Civil War is the transition in American religious history from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And Lincoln now becomes,
if you can guess, the sacrificial servant. Servant or the Christ figure. And
the Gettysburg Address now It's part of the Lincolnian New Testament, many people have said. I didn't bring the Gettysburg Address along, but if you ever read it sometime, notice all the birth images that are devoted to those who die. Brought forth, conceived, created, a new birth of freedom. Many people think this is the beginning of the New Testament and the theme of sacrifice. Lincoln's law partner, I have a quote from Lincoln's law partner who wrote about Abe Lincoln after he had died. He writes, "For 50 years God rolled Abraham Lincoln through his fiery furnace. He did it to try Abraham and to purify him for his purposes. This made Mr. Lincoln humble, tender, forbearing, sympathetic to suffering, kind, sensitive, tolerant, broadening, deepening, and widening his whole nature, making him the noblest and loveliest character since Jesus Christ. I believe that Lincoln was God's chosen one." And Walt Whitman also wrote quite a bit about Lincoln in that way as a Christ figure. The important thing to understand about the Civil War is that it's not just a conflict between slave owners and free soil people, or North and South, or two different kinds of economic systems. But in a very deep sense, we can see it as a struggle between a struggle, just as the Puritans saw it, as a struggle to preserve the will of God on earth. For Lincoln, the issue was not slavery, but whether that nation or any nation so conceived or dedicated can long endure. He came up with the phrase, America is the last best hope on earth, very similar to Thomas Jefferson's phrase of the world's best hope. Again, there's a sense that we can't fail. There's just too much at stake. If America failed now, freedom everywhere would fail. There's no expense too great, no price too great to pay for preserving the experiment of self-government, because this is the will of God for the future, and not just for America, but for the whole world, that we should be able to spread out and share our values to all. So those who fought for the Union were given ultimate significance on the battlefield. And Lincoln said, "Those who gave their lives that the nation might live." And this is the beginning of the notion that dying for one's country becomes very close to a holy sacrifice for the sake of God. And that, again, does not stop after the Civil War, but continues on. I'm not going to get into Memorial Day, but I spent a whole month on an independent study talking about, or studying the history of Memorial Day, and which started out of the Civil War, and the beginning of glorifying our soldiers on May 31st each year. Glorifying soldiers who died so that their nation might live. Maybe we can have a session on that some other time. I just think it's real interesting how soldiers, if you ever go to a Memorial Day observance sometime, notice how soldiers are really elevated to as if they have sacrificed for God. It's 10 after. I don't think I'm going to go any farther, but the same thing comes out in the Spanish-American War, First World War, Woodrow Wilson, Make the World Safe for Democracy, the war to end all wars. World War II, certainly, the godless communists versus the self-righteous Americans, and on and on. And I think it's still true today to some extent. But I think I'll open it by asking the question, do we have a mission? And if we do, what is it? Or are there any places where you see our mission being fulfilled or unfulfilled? Shouldn't a nation have a mission?
Are you talking about right now or projecting into the future?
Well, either.
I don't know. Why do those people just keep coming here?
We had a conscious mission quotation that's inscribed on the Statue of Liberty. It invited the people to homeless masses learning to be free. But we are having some problems with that these days. But still, we have consciously taken in significant numbers of refugees, not just from places like Hungary where they look like us, but also from Southeast Asia.
That would be, a positive side to America's mission. Close to number one up here, that America would serve as a model to the nations, would take in people and live in a free society.
From Cuba, but not from Haiti.
Yeah. Mary?
Well, you hear a lot of people say that we're one of the most generous countries on earth, and yet 0.024 of our, or 0.24 of our gross national product goes for foreign aid, and much of that is in military aid instead of food or development, and that ranks like 14th or 15th out of 17 nations in the world as far as the proportion. So we're not very sharing. I guess I'd like to see America's mission as being, because we do have the technology, and I mean, I don't think what we have is blessing. I think it's come from exploitation and manipulation, but our mission to me would be to share, to try to share what we have and to help nations that are in a developing state and not always do it in order to protect our interests. I think we could be a powerful influence in the world, and I just think we go at it absolutely the wrong way.
But if we're not a sharing nation, if we haven't been very generous, then why do we think we still are? Why hasn't this image of American mission just gone down the tubes? Or has it ever? Why do we still have this conception of ourselves as a great nation when it's very evident that, I think we have some honest history books.
Because we always end up winning, or it looks like we're winners.
Because everything comes so easy. Remember what Winthrop said. Let's see. If we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall shame the faces of the many God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are going. Well, that never happened. Everything went very smoothly. Everything came very easily. We were not forced out of the land. We didn't have a lot of famines or floods that showed us that we had failed. Is that part of the reason why we still have this conception of ourselves as a great missionary to the world? Is there any point at which this broke down? What happened during Watergate, Vietnam? What happened to our image of ourselves?
We start to see it. It seems to me if you get outside the country, you get a whole different picture of what's going on in the United States when you're dealing with domestic kind of stuff. And with Watergate, you finally had to look at it.
Mm-hmm. That was the point at which we started questioning, what is our mission? And can we take this black and white, good and bad, into a civil war of another country? And it just didn't work. And we didn't win. So that was a point at which we had to really struggle with, hey, do we have a destiny? Do we have a mission? Are we as good of a people as we thought we were?
Yeah,
but what happened to that? I mean, why? I was an American Studies major at about during all of this, right after Vietnam and the post-Vietnam days. And in studying all of this theme of mission, we just sort of assumed that had died now, that Vietnam and Watergate was over. What happened, I get the sense that we still are a very strong nation. What happened?
Didn't we just forget? Part of the reason Vietnam veterans are neglected is that they're symbols of our failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's almost assuming we can forget that. But then part of the way of forgetting is to forget them.
When did that happen that we?
Didn't Iran have a lot of people?
That's what I was when I first noticed that we had it back again was the yellow ribbons around the trees. I mean, that was the first time that we were really united against a common enemy. And that was the same time that Ronald Reagan was elected, who has the dreams of the past. And the Vietnam days are over. We can go back now to doing what we've been doing before. Anyone get that sense around that time of the hostage crisis that we are again unified with a mission?
Right. I think the environmental movement had something to do with it too. And I think it still does. That we don't have to punish and poison and all of that and all the stuff that we did in Vietnam. And I think that it's still reflected in the polls how many people who want a clean environment, even though they want to go back into the exploitative past of Ronald Reagan, they still want to have their cake and eat it too.
I always felt like the Watergate was just, we kind of felt there was one bad egg or one bad apple in the barrel and we got rid of that. Mm-hmm. And Nixon was kind of the scapegoat in a sense, mm-hmm, for a lot of our evils, but we didn't look at the evils so much as here was one bad man, supposedly. Mm-hmm. So if he's gone, then we can go back to just the way we were. And we apologize that there was one bad apple.
They kept saying, see, the system works.
Mm-hmm.
We got rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find it kind of ironic that now Nixon is almost respectable again, that he's sent off to President Sadat's funeral and is interviewed in Newsweek and Time and is all buddy-buddies with Carter and Ford and all the rest, you know. It's such a change from 74.
There was a poll taken in Columbus this spring, and one of the questions was, if Nixon were eligible to run for office again, do you think he would be elected? And like 75% of the people who responded said yes.
Is there a challenge anywhere today to the notion of our mission? I mean, do you see challenges to it?
Sure, El Salvador.
Peace movement.
The civil rights movement, I don't think was a real, I mean, some people interpret it as a challenge to the American dream or American sense of mission, and I'm not sure that it was. I think it was black people asking to be included in that. And I think today there's a much more fundamental challenge to the whole notion that we have a mission, like Roxas and El Salvador. Yeah, Mike?
Isn't Christianity itself a challenge? That's what I see it as. I know.
I want to take that up on Friday. How much have we been sucked into that? And what does Wallace mean by the American captivity of the church? Can Christianity be a challenge to that?
I think that's the whole betrayal of evangelism, is what he's talking about. I'm so glad you tied those two in together.
Has it been so far? Right?
Pardon?
Has it been so far?
Not that I've seen.
some branches, man. But I think that the papers and these churches have all along the line.
Yeah. But as John said the other night, the violence has done more to affect the churches than the churches have done to affect violence. In fact, this religion in America is, I think, one of the main reasons that we have had so much violence. I want to just read one paragraph from a book called The Wars of America. It says, the mission of American destiny, always latent, came to most authentic and articulate expression in times of crisis, hence the illuminating qualities of war. Given the prevailing ideology, Americans could not help but think that their wars were just, precisely because their historic role in the world was just. Thus, Americans often fell into the temptation noted above and converted their just wars into crusades, because no less than the fate of the world depended upon an American victory. As we have seen in previous essays, America entered none of its wars as a crusade initially, but in the prosecution of war, the high stakes involved became apparent. And the ideology came to clear and heightened expression. And it's still true in the nuclear age. we're willing to use nuclear weapons because so much is at stake.
It's scary. You take a people that have all this ideology and give them a bomb and give them atomic weapons, and it's really scary.
Well, it's past coffee break. Let's break.